Chapter 7.
Cornelia, May 21, 1923. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord, the priest intoned. Cornelia glanced sideways along the length of the pew. At first she had doubted her own wisdom in suggesting that Evangeline should attend the funeral. But seeing her protege so pale and sincere in a black dress, and flanked by her two handsome sons, she reversed her position and decided that she had once again engineered a stroke of genius. Evangeline had resisted, saying the funeral was a family affair. The family would surely want to be left in peace. "No, dear," Cornelia said, persuasively. "They would want you there. You tried to help them, dear. They know that. They'll surely welcome you." "Perhaps they will," said Evangeline, "but they won't welcome the crowds of reporters who follow me wherever I go." "We'll keep the reporters away," said Cornelia. "You know me better than that. Would I allow this private family affair to turn into a circus?" Evangeline laughed in her face. "You would if you thought it would do anything at all for your cause," she said. "I'm not going." She sounded as though she had made up her mind, and Cornelia was willing to admit defeat. But then, suddenly, Evangeline had a change of heart. The only thing she could put it down to was the fact that Joshua McLaren, slightly less dour than usual, had actually invited Evangeline to go along with him. Evangeline seemed dazzled by the fact that McLaren was wearing a suit and tie, had combed his hair and shaved his beard, and was looking about 20 years younger and really quite smart. Cornelia certainly hoped that Evangeline was not going to turn out to be the sort of person who would be impressed by a man in a suit. Oh well, she thought, whatever the reason, having Evangeline in the church was good for the cause. The church itself was definitely a disappointment so far as getting good pictures for the press. Cornelia had imagined they would be in a pretty little building, like the church at Queenston, with stained glass windows and a garden of gravestones and roses, where Evangeline could be photographed looking at the graves and maybe pondering her own fate. However, this particular church turned out to be a grimy, poverty-stricken building in an unpleasant industrial village, where the entire skyline was crisscrossed with high-voltage electricity cables. The morning was gloomy, and the air was fouled with smoke and chemical fumes. The creek that ran past the church and through the heart of the nasty little village was a river of foul-smelling sludge. Even the priest, who was now in the midst of committing Richard Steinhaus to his eternal rest, was a stuttering little man in a grim surplice. The only bonus that Cornelia could think of was that Evangeline appeared more attractive than ever, glowing like a rare flower among the depressing surroundings and the gloomy people. McLaren had appeared to be on his best behavior until they actually entered the church and met the family. One of them, possibly the father, asked McLaren to do him the honor of reading the lesson. For some reason, McLaren had reverted to type and refused them, quite rudely. As everyone stood in shocked silence, Danny offered to take his uncle's place. Cornelia knew that she was not a sensitive woman and that she had little patience for the rituals of society, but even she knew that this was inappropriate. Seeing Danny in glowing health would only serve to underscore the loss of their own child. Surely even McLaren could see that. McLaren didn't seem to care. He took his seat and glared out at the congregation, a fixed expression on his face. "Odious man," Cornelia said under her breath. "There's more to him than meets the eye," said Iris. "Not so far as I'm concerned," said Cornelia. "He's the worst of a bad breed. I shall be glad when this is over and we're done with him." The priest read from the prayer book and the Bible. The mourners sang a suitably mournful hymn, and then everyone processed from the church to the churchyard. Cornelia was relieved to see that the reporters who had been banned from the church itself were crowded along the fence, doing their best to take pictures. The priest read again. The clods of earth were thrown into the deep, dark hole, and it was over and done. Iris, who had even been more restless than usual throughout the whole proceeding, suddenly grabbed Cornelia's arm and tried to pull her away from everyone else. "What on earth is the matter with you?" Cornelia hissed, her mind intent on getting Evangeline outside to meet the reporters.
"He's over there," said Iris, "on the other side of the road. Can you see him?"
"See who, Iris? I don't know what you're talking about."
"Oh, no, of course you don't," Iris agreed. "I haven't told you yet, have I? I wonder if I should try to talk to him."
"How much longer," Cornelia said to herself, "how much longer before I don't need her or her money?" She grabbed Iris by the shoulder to hold her still. "You get sillier every day," she said. "Put your hat on straight and try to stand still. I'm going to talk to the boy's mother. Maybe she can be converted to our cause. After all, if she didn't have so many children, just look at them all lined up there. If there weren't so many of them, maybe she'd be able to do a better job of watching them, and they wouldn't go wandering off and drowning themselves. Think what an argument that makes for birth control. I'm sure she didn't want to have so many children. I'm certain it was her husband's idea."
"I don't think this is quite the right moment," Iris said. "She does seem very upset. And anyway, we really should be looking at the man across the road. Oh, I don't know what to do about him."
"What man?" Cornelia asked.
Iris shook her head. "He's gone now. But he was here. I know he was."
"I'm going to talk to the mother," said Cornelia. Iris tugged on her sleeve.
"Please don't. Please don't. It's not the right time, Cornelia. Try to understand."
"I'll never understand all of this nonsense of men and children and domestic drudgery," Cornelia confessed, "but I suppose you're right. I'll leave her alone for today. It looks like Mr. McLaren's getting ready to leave. We'd better go with him. Such a horrible man. He's just like all men. I wouldn't trust him any further than I could see him. All they want is a woman's body."
"Surely he hasn't bothered you," Iris said.
Cornelia hesitated on the edge of a lie. She believed in principle that all men, whatever their age or circumstance, wanted only one thing from women, and she had long ago decided that she would resist them every step of the way. But she could not really say that Mr. McLaren had done or said anything inappropriate to her. She settled for an all-purpose statement.
"I know what he wants," she said. "He doesn't have to spell it out."
"I think he's rather wonderful," Iris said wistfully, gazing across the churchyard at McLaren's tall figure. Cornelia shook her head in amazement. Surely Iris couldn't be attracted to that man. And yet the hopeless yearning was evident in every feature of the younger woman's face. The pain was written clearly in her timid eyes and quivering mouth. Cornelia turned away, trying to fit this information into a new equation. Iris yearned for McLaren. McLaren appeared to have eyes only for Evangeline, and Evangeline thought only of the Falls. Even Nell McLaren had an admirer in the person of Mattie Ferguson, who was constantly glancing sideways at her and then looking away with a coughing fit. Well, Cornelia thought, however strange these affections were, they were serving to keep all the people in place. So long as the circle of unrequited longing stayed in place, none of them were going to leave. She would do what she had to do to break it up just as soon as Evangeline had completed her contract. The vicar awaited them at the church gate, his prayer book clutched to his narrow chest, and a fanatical expression on his face. Evangeline murmured an appropriate comment on the excellence of his eulogy and tried to pass. He stretched out a hand to stop her. "God has told me to warn you," he declared fervently.
"I'm sorry," said Evangeline. "I don't know what you mean."
"God is not pleased with you," the priest declared.
"Oh, I'm sorry," said Evangeline. "I did my best to save the boy. I really did."
"But who will save you?" the priest asked.
"I'm hoping Mr. McLaren will," said Evangeline. "I have every faith in him."
"Misplaced faith," the priest said. "Put not your faith in humans. You are flouting God's law, and you will reap the consequences."
Cornelia could see that Evangeline was becoming distressed, and the other people around were staring at the priest in puzzlement. What was he doing? Was he preaching? Was he trying to save her soul? Why pick on Evangeline?
Whatever the reason for his actions, she decided to put an end to them. It was never a good idea to make enemies in the community, but really, this was too much. However, just as Cornelia was about to speak and put the priest firmly in his place, Joshua McLaren stretched a long arm over Evangeline's shoulder and gripped the priest's upper arm. "There'll be none of that talk," he said firmly. "Not to this lady. There might be some who need reminding about God's laws, but she is not one of them.
That's what you think, the priest said, and he triumphantly thrust his open prayer book in front of Joshua's face.
Read that, he said with passion. Go on, read it. If she comes to grief, McLaren, I'll not bury her, and neither will any other priest.
McLaren pushed the book away. Don't be a bigger fool than you can help, he said. I don't have time for reading your nonsense.
Oh, wait a minute, said Jeremy Murray. This is all rather quaint. Let me look.
The priest stabbed his finger at the prayer book, and Jeremy studied the words.
Oh, said Jeremy, I see what he's getting at. But really, no one takes this stuff literally anymore.
I do, the priest insisted.
Well, I don't, and neither does my mother, said Jeremy.
What does it say? Frank said. His brother read from the prayer book.
Let it be noted that this order of burial is not to be used for any that die excommunicated or who have laid violent hands upon themselves.
Frank shrugged. I have no idea what he's getting at.
Jeremy closed the book by snapping it under the priest's nose.
It means that this priest draws the line at burying a suicide, and he regards our dear mother's project as suicide.
Oh dear, Iris whispered to Cornelia. I never thought of that.
Don't be so silly, Iris, said Cornelia. She's not committing suicide. She has a fighting chance.
Joshua McLaren turned away from all of them and strode towards his car.
There you are, Mrs. Murray, he said over his shoulder. Even God won't want you if you do this stupid thing.
I don't think it has anything to do with God, Evangeline shouted after him. And anyway, I wouldn't want to be buried in this nasty little place. You can just go ahead and bury me at the crossroads, if that will make you happy.
Cornelia took her protege's arm, mindful of the hovering reporters.
No one is going to bury anyone, she said firmly.
And then, to change the subject, she said,
has it ever occurred to you that God might be a woman?
Well, he's certainly not a red-headed Scotsman, Evangeline answered.
Cornelia smiled, satisfied that all was well. Iris might be infatuated with the obnoxious Scotsman, but Evangeline most certainly was not.
Evangeline, May 22, 1923. Evangeline really didn't know what to do about Joshua McLaren. One minute she hated him and everything he stood for, and the next minute all she could think of was breaking through his wall of anger and hurt and finding the real man underneath. Why did she care? Was it the challenge? Obviously, it was many years since Joshua had cared for anyone. Many years since he had held a woman in his arms and spoken softly, maybe even tenderly. He's not old, she thought. Just thinks he's old. When she had seen him dressed in his suit and tie for the funeral, she had experienced a deep physical attraction for him. But every time that he spoke, they argued. She's wasting her energy on a man who obviously thinks she's a fool. But she really couldn't stop thinking about him. Maybe idle fantasies about Joshua McLaren whispering sweet nothings in her ear were preferable to thinking about the barrel and the falls and the sudden demands of her sons. She was alone in her bedroom, struggling into her skin-tight bathing suit and looking at herself in the mirror. She clung to his few words of faint praise. You're an attractive woman, Mrs. Murray. It's just because there's no one else, she told herself. And because you like a challenge. Joshua McLaren was a strong man, physically and mentally. What would it be like to see that strength surrendered to her? Conquering Joshua McLaren, well, it's all part of the conquering of the falls. Don't take it seriously. What did she know about the man himself apart from the fact that he seemed to be consumed with the loss of his son, the horror of the trenches, and some other fear that caused him to cry out in the night? In his solitary room at the back of the house, he was fighting some lonely battle of his own, with some memory she could never share. The mirror in the bedroom was badly placed for a full-length view. She had to climb onto the bed to see herself. She twisted and turned. Not bad. Not bad at all. The bathing suit was navy blue, with a white sailor collar trimmed in red. It was a far cry from a suit of long underwear. She shrugged into a long white bathrobe and went out to meet her public, most especially Joshua McLaren.
As she had come to expect, the journalists and photographers were assembled in large numbers. Cornelia was granting preliminary interviews, with Nell and Iris in close attendance. Jeremy and Frank added their own particular elegance to the scene, and Danny McLaren was a positive volcano of enthusiasm. "Ready, Mrs. Murray?" the official photographer asked. "We'll have you pose right here, alongside the barrel." She saw Joshua guarding the barrel, and her heart lurched. What if he could read her thoughts? What would he say if he knew that she was determined to make him her next conquest? She smiled to herself, ruefully admitting that he was quite likely to be unconquerable. If he hadn't made a move with all the opportunities she'd given him already, he wasn't going to make one now. What did she really have to go on? Just one sentence. "You're an attractive woman, Mrs. Murray." "Mr. McLaren, if we could have you in the picture, please," the photographer said. "You don't need me," Joshua growled. "Just take the picture of Mrs. Murray. She's the one you're interested in." "No, no, both of you together. If you would take your robe off, please, Mrs. Murray." "Why should she take her robe off?" Joshua asked. Evangeline drew a deep breath. The bathing dress had seemed perfectly appropriate when she had modeled it for the committee ladies. Now, surrounded by men, she wasn't so sure. "Come along, Evangeline," Cornelia said. "We don't have all day. I'll hold your robe." She held out her hand for the robe, and Evangeline had no choice but to take it off. She dared not look at Joshua. Her plan to throw him a bold glance and see him respond with a sudden flash of passion now seemed absurd. He was scarcely looking at her at all. So she posed. Standing tall, smiling, she was very aware of him just behind her, giving off an aura of disapproval. The photographer ducked his head under the black cloth. "Smile," he ordered. "You too, Mr. McLaren. Step in a little closer and look at Mrs. Murray." "No, no, you're not looking at her. Look at her." "Oh, that's better." She could feel him standing next to her, hear the sound of his breathing, and smell his distinctive scent of sawdust and pipe tobacco. He looked at her. There was a blinding flash, and it was done. It was, of course, only the first of many, and eventually Evangeline became accustomed to her own lack of clothing. But Joshua moved away, returning his attention to the barrel and grumbling that he didn't have time for all this nonsense. As Joshua returned to his work on the barrel, Evangeline heard a disturbance brewing in the doorway. Someone was pushing their way in from outside. Evangeline saw a large, somewhat elderly lady in a black skirt, rusted with age, and a white blouse with a none-too-clean lace collar. "Out of my way, out of my way!" The woman had a grating voice which couldn't be ignored. "Come along, let me through." Evangeline forced her way into the front row of spectators, who had momentarily forgotten about the blue bathing suit, and were looking at this new attraction. "Good heavens," Joshua said. "It's Mrs. Taylor. Get her a seat, someone." He hurried to her side. "Mrs. Taylor, what are you doing down here? How did you get here?" The old woman peered up at him. Finally, she nodded. "Josh, that is you, isn't it?"
"Aye. You're getting old, Josh."
"You say that every time, Mrs. Taylor."
"It's because it's the truth. I like to tell the truth."
Mrs. Taylor seated herself on a chair that had been found for her.
"Who's in charge here?" she asked.
"I am," said Cornelia.
"Cornelia Braithwaite, editor of the Women's Free Press, and you are?"
"Annie Edson Taylor, Queen of the Mist."
Evangeline was amazed. This was her, Annie Edson Taylor, the first person to survive the falls. That had been 22 years ago. Evangeline had assumed that this old lady was dead. No one had ever spoken of her as though she was alive. She looked like she was getting on in years, but she was still quite robust. It was easy to say that she had once been a really big woman and no beauty. Heavy features, thin lips, small eyes, and big hands and feet, not to mention the grating voice and the belligerent manner.
"I don't get out much these days," she said. "The world's full of thieves and charlatans, but I need some money. There's nothing left to bury me with, and I'm not going to be put into a pauper's grave, not after what I've done. Pay me and I'll pose for you.
We don't need it, Cornelia said. Evangeline is all the publicity we need.
Mrs. Taylor laughed.
I'm the real story, she said. I'm the one with the famous name. Who is this Evangeline? She's a nobody. Until she's challenged the falls and survived, she's a nothing. Any fool can go over the falls. It's surviving that's the trick.
Well, said Cornelia.
Mrs. Taylor interrupted her.
You pay me and you get your picture. If you don't pay me, I'll turn around and walk right out again. Anyone takes my picture without permission, and I'll set the law on him.
My newspaper will be happy to pay you, the photographer said eagerly, for an exclusive.
Call it whatever you like, said Mrs. Taylor. Where do I stand?
Over here by the barrel, Cornelia said.
All right, all right.
Mrs. Taylor heaved herself to her feet.
And where's the woman?
I'm right here, said Evangeline. Annie Taylor looked her up and down, pursing her lips.
Scandalous, she said finally. What have you got on? Joshua, have you talked to this woman?
I've tried to, Mrs. Taylor, Joshua said.
How can you appear in public like that? Mrs. Taylor asked. This is what I wore, this very blouse and this very skirt, and I was careful about pinning up my hair. I don't know what you're thinking of showing your body off that way, and your hair hanging down like that. It's appalling. I've changed my mind.
Annie Taylor sat down again.
Mrs. Taylor, the photographer protested. But Annie Edson Taylor was fiercely determined to have things her own way.
Get out, she said. All of you get out and let me talk to this floozy for a minute. I'll soon straighten her out. Go on, all of you get out.
Within a few moments, the boat shed had emptied, except for Evangeline and Annie Taylor. Evangeline had been tempted to leave with the crowd, but she had not been able to slip past the old woman. Annie Taylor might be old and might be eccentric, but she certainly wasn't blind.
Now then, young woman, said Mrs. Taylor.
She hesitated and looked at Evangeline again, carefully.
No, you're not as young as I thought, she corrected herself. You're no spring chicken, are you? I was 42 myself when I made the ride.
So I've heard, said Evangeline.
It takes that long for a woman to really know what she wants, Annie said.
She extended a bony hand and fingered the fabric of Evangeline's bathing suit.
Is that really what you're going to wear?
Evangeline nodded.
Oh, well, Mrs. Taylor sighed. I don't suppose it will make any difference. You'll either be dead or you won't be dead. And if you die, the river's going to strip the clothes off you anyway. I'll tell you, my dear, my blouse, my skirt, and all my petticoats didn't stop me from getting bruised. I might just as well have been wearing nothing at all.
She beckoned Evangeline closer with an imperious finger.
The real reason I wore all these clothes, she said softly, is that I have several tattoos which I didn't want anyone to see.
Tattoos? Evangeline said in astonishment. Annie Taylor nodded.
Tattoos, she repeated. I have lived a very interesting life. The falls were not my only adventure.
Obviously not, said Evangeline.
Read my book, said Mrs. Taylor. I've written about my whole life. I'm not an ordinary kind of woman, never was. You, on the other hand, seem very ordinary.
Well, I thought so too, said Evangeline. But now I'm not so sure. I really want to do this. I'm not going to let anyone change my mind.
I was a school teacher once, said Mrs. Taylor, in a little school in Michigan. They all thought I was ordinary, but I wasn't. And I didn't like being poor. I wanted to be rich, and I wanted to be famous.
That's what I want, said Evangeline. Not just money.
Fame. I want fame.
Annie Taylor sighed.
Fame doesn't put bread on the table. Not without something else. Look at me. I was famous, and now I don't have a penny. If it wasn't for Josh McLaren, I'd have starved to death a long time ago.
Mr. McLaren? Evangeline asked. Josh, she thought to herself. I wonder if I should call him Josh.
You know who I mean, said Mrs. Taylor. Red-headed fella, though he's going a bit gray now, I see. Not getting any younger, I suppose. He's always helped me out. He was the first face I saw when they opened the barrel. I didn't know if I was alive or dead, and suddenly there was all this light coming in and Josh pulling me out. I couldn't stand up. My legs felt like rubber. It took two men to hold me. I was a strapping big woman in those days.
What was it like? Evangeline asked.
Do you really want to know?
Yes. Whatever you say will make no difference. I'm determined to do it. But I'd like to know what to expect. You're the only person who can tell me.
You're right, said Annie. I'm the only one. The Queen of the Mist. That's what they call me. There was one other who survived. A boastful little nuisance who stole my thunder.
Bobby Leach? Evangeline asked.
Annie nodded her head. You've been reading your history. Yes, Bobby Leach. People stopped listening to me and started listening to him. They said he had better stage presence. Stage presence. What has stage presence to do with it? That's what I'd like to know. Either you have courage or you don't.
Annie Taylor smiled smugly.
Anyway, I've outlived him, she said. Silly bugger, slipped on a banana peel out there in New Zealand and killed himself. Goes over the falls and dies on a banana peel. There's justice for you.
Yes, of course, Evangeline said. If you could just tell me... There was no need for further prompting.
Annie Taylor launched herself into the story of her famous exploit, the words tumbling from her mouth in the well-remembered phrases of her long-ago abandoned lectures. Occasionally, she smoothed her moth-eaten skirt or patted her sparse gray hair. The words flowed smoothly.
Everyone told me it couldn't be done, but I knew it could. I designed the barrel myself and sent it on a test ride. I had no one to help me, no one at all. A woman is always alone when she sets herself against the men of this world. I put a cat in the barrel, a mangy old thing I found on a farm upriver. I didn't think anyone would miss it. You wouldn't believe the fuss that animal made before I got it into the barrel. I still think about that cat sometimes. If the cat hadn't died, I would have.
Oh, said Evangeline, thinking of the poor frantic cat. Did it die?
Sure did, said Annie carelessly. The barrel survived the fall, but the cat inside was stone cold dead. No air, you see. It used up all the air. So I said to myself, if a little cat can use up all the air in just 3 hours, how long is it going to take a grown woman to run out of air? Not long, I reckoned. That's why I made a breathing tube.
So that's what he meant, said Evangeline.
What who meant?
I'm thinking of a conversation I had with Mr. McLaren, Evangeline replied. He was asking me how I was planning to breathe. Evangeline's thoughts drifted away. That was the conversation when she'd made such a fool of herself, being so outspoken and unladylike about Cornelia. She would never, never forget the look of shock on Joshua's face when she had declared that Cornelia was a lesbian. And despite his obvious shock, she'd just gone on babbling like an insensitive idiot. She'd been so busy teasing him for his narrow-mindedness that she hadn't listened to the other things he was saying. All he'd been doing was trying to keep her from suffocating. By the time she concentrated on Annie's story again, the old lady was already at the point where she'd been nailed down in the barrel and sent on her way.
Dark it was, she said, and stuffy, and me trying not to breathe too deep and use up all the air. I didn't know how long I'd have to wait for the fall, but believe me, girl, you'll know it when it comes.
Was it really awful? Evangeline asked.
Annie shrugged her shoulders.
Depends on what you call awful. I just thought of it as something that had to be done first so that I could get out afterwards and become rich. But there was a moment.
She paused.
I'll tell you this. I never before told a living soul. I don't want people to think that I'm crazy. There was a moment when I seemed to have no weight at all. It was though I was floating in midair, and in the darkness I saw a rainbow.
The Maid of the Mist, Evangeline suggested.
Maybe, said Annie. But I don't believe in that sort of thing. But I did see it, I can't deny it. And the next thing I saw was Joshua McLaren gaping at me as though I'd been raised from the dead.
That's what I'm looking forward to, said Evangeline. Not Mr. McLaren, she added hastily. I mean the amazement on everyone's faces when I finally do this.
I fancied young Josh, said Annie. Oh, don't look so shocked. I was too old for him even then, but he was a good-looking piece of work, and I fancied him. Not that it's got me anywhere. Not then and not now. He's never gotten over losing his wife. 20 years it's been. You'd think he'd be over it by now.
She must have been very special, Evangeline said.
She didn't look special to me, but who knows what men find special. I've had offers you wouldn't believe, from men who thought it would be something to brag about. You know, how I conquered the falls and they conquered me. That was a while ago. I haven't had any offers lately. She shrugged her shoulders. I should have accepted one of them. I might not be so hard up today. She stood up suddenly. Oh, well, I've played my little game with them, she said. So you better let the photographers in. They'll be so relieved that I've changed my mind that they'll give me a higher price. I might be old, girl, but I'm not a fool.
Evangeline went obediently to the door.
Incidentally, said Annie Taylor, don't expect me to come cheering you on. I don't need any competition. I'm not ready to give up my crown. Personally, I hope you fall flat on your face and drown.
Joshua, October 24, 1901. Joshua McLaren struggled to keep his position on the spray-soaked rock. There were too many men huddled together on the narrow surface, and they were all in danger of being dumped into the roaring rapids below the falls. Joshua's most immediate danger came from Bill Hillsgrove, determined, as always, to be in the spotlight.
"She's over!" shouted Harry Williams, who, by virtue of his ownership of the largest hotel at the falls, had claimed the highest ground.
Moments later, the Maid of the Mist steam whistle split the air with a trio of shrill blasts.
"She surfaced! She surfaced!" Bill Hillgrove shouted.
Joshua couldn't see the barrel, but he knew that the signal was as agreed. The skipper of the sturdy Maid of the Mist steamer, nosing into the foaming waters as close as he dared to come to the falls, had seen the barrel break the surface.
"Are they picking her up?" Kid Brady asked.
The token athlete in the rescue party, the world-famous featherweight, was so much shorter than the men surrounding him that he pulled at their sleeves in frustration.
"She's gone again," Harry Williams said, stepping down from his vantage point. "Hey, Josh, you're head and shoulders over the rest of us. Come up here and keep an eye out. I can't stand the suspense any longer."
Williams turned his back to the spray and tried to light a cigar, and Joshua climbed up onto the vantage point to watch the action.
"No sign of her," he said.
Along the banks of the Niagara, the crowd grew restless. After a failed attempt the day before, Annie Taylor had finally been launched into the river at 4 p.m. The crowd now began to fear that darkness would descend before they had a chance to see her pulled from the river. Alive or dead made no difference. They just wanted to see her. They wanted to know what the river had done to her.
"She's been pulled under again," Bill Hillsgrove said with a gloomy satisfaction. "I knew she would. I knew this silly old cow wouldn't make it. She'll suffocate. We'd all be best off waiting down by the whirlpool. You won't see her again until she gets there. No hurry, it'll take a couple of days."
"Shut your mouth," said Joshua.
"Shut yours," Bill replied. "I'm only saying what everyone else is thinking."
Joshua continued to stare into the foaming waters.
"Why doesn't the boat go in?"
asked Kit Brady, expressing the frustration that they all felt as they waited helplessly.
"He's got more sense than that," said Williams. "He can't take her in any closer."
"She didn't stand a chance," Bill Hillsgrove repeated gloomily.
The men nodded. It had been a ridiculous idea from the start, made even more ridiculous by the woman who was planning it. Who was she anyway, this Annie Edson Taylor? What right had this upstart woman who claimed to be a school teacher from Michigan to come into their world and challenge all their notions of what could be done and what could not? There wasn't a man in the group who hadn't given a passing thought to riding over the falls in a barrel. But not one of them would have tried it. Joshua was the closest they had to a hero, with his repeated rescues of foundering swimmers and boaters downriver in the Whirlpool Rapids, and even he would not challenge the falls. To add insult to injury, they didn't even find the woman attractive, plain as a pikestaff, in fact, and none too friendly. Her biggest insult to them had been her refusal to take their advice on the design of her barrel, and her refusal to take on any of them as her manager. Joshua focused his attention on the churning waters. He thought he saw something.
He blinked again, and then wiped his eyes with the back of his hand. Yes, there it was, floating freely.
There it is, he shouted, and immediately he was pushed from his perch by the clamorous men.
She's in the eddy, Williams yelled. That'll bring her this way, said Hillsgrove knowingly. We don't have to do nothing. She'll come over on her own.
Not all the way in, Joshua argued. The current will swing her round again. We'll have to go in after her.
No point, said Hillsgrove. She's bound to be dead.
I'll go after her, said Kid Brady. Someone hold my coat.
We need a boat, Joshua argued, but his words were muffled as he stripped off his own jacket and prepared to join the featherweight fighter. All it would take is a couple of strong men in a boat, he repeated. Even as he scrambled down the rocks, he spared a thought for his wife and young son, hoping that they weren't watching him. Maggie and Callum worried so much about him, and he hated to have anyone worrying about him.
No time, said Kid Brady.
No time, Joshua agreed.
You'll end up dead as she is, Bill Hillsgrove prophesied.
Better dead than a coward, Kid Brady muttered.
Just hold the rope, Joshua ordered, throwing Hillsgrove the end of the rope that he was tying around himself and Brady.
They plunged together into the water. Warmed by an unusually hot summer, the waters of the Niagara welcomed the two men with no more than a slight chill. They struck out towards the barrel and grasped it as it whirled in towards the shore. Riding the barrel to the safety of the shore, Joshua looked up and saw the crowd high above him lining the gorge. Their roars of approval melded with the roars of the water.
I hope she's alive, gasped Kid Brady from the other side of the barrel.
Aye, said Joshua. This is too much trouble just to rescue a corpse.
Joshua, May 22, 1923. Joshua thought about Annie Taylor's moment of triumph so many years ago as he helped the old lady into his car. It seemed like another world, another lifetime, when he had been so young and foolhardy and so careless of the worries of Maggie and Callum. Well, they couldn't worry about him now, not where they were.
I can take the bus, Annie protested. It's no trouble to drive you, he said, and it's a long walk to the bus stop.
Don't expect me to talk to you, she said. I keep my own counsel. I'm not telling you what that ridiculous Evangeline woman said.
I don't want to know, Joshua replied.
And so each one, true to their own stubborn natures, the pair of them rode in silence for the rest of the journey. When Joshua returned to the boat shed, he was surprised to find Evangeline Murray waiting for him. He was relieved to see that she was fully dressed. While she had been forced to parade around the boat shed in her bathing suit, he had felt embarrassed for her and embarrassed for himself. Her embarrassment had seemed to wear off quite rapidly, but his own reaction to her was not so easy to deal with. He had felt downright lustful, which was something he had not experienced recently. He was quite shocked to find that he was unable to keep his body under full control, and he spent most of the time hidden behind a barrel. Now that he was alone with her, he wanted to say something pleasant, but what he did say was neither pleasant nor encouraging.
No more pictures. I'm not going to be in any more pictures.
She smiled.
No, no more pictures. You don't like having your picture taken, do you?
This is your party, Mrs. Murray, and not mine, he growled at her. I don't know why people keep pushing me into the limelight.
Because you're an interesting man, and they probably think they can sell more newspapers if they invent a romance or something between the two of us. He looked at her face. Her expression implied that she knew very well that the idea of such a romance was ridiculous.
That would be absurd, he said.
But he continued to look at her and detected what might have been a blush.
Mrs. Taylor told me something interesting, Evangeline said, seemingly eager to change the subject. Joshua couldn't imagine why she had introduced it in the first place.
Aye?
She was telling me about the difficulty she had breathing and about the cat that died.
Joshua laughed and felt himself relax now that they were on familiar territory.
Between you and me, Mrs. Murray, he said,
I think that's the main reason she never made more of a name for herself. People never forgave her for killing that cat. It's one thing to risk your own life, but it's another to go killing innocent animals, especially if they don't happen to belong to you.
You were trying to tell me the other day about breathing in the barrel, weren't you? Evangeline said. Then I said some very unladylike things. I'm sorry about that. I shouldn't have teased you. Joshua shrugged his shoulders. Maybe you're right, and I'm narrow-minded and stubborn. Nell gave me a piece of her mind and told me that I'm a miserable old devil who tries to rule everybody's life. Evangeline laughed. She was teasing again. Oh, I don't know, she said. Devil, maybe. Perhaps even miserable. But I don't think of you as old. Old enough to be your father, said Joshua. Evangeline shook her head. I doubt that, she said. And she looked at him again full in the face. Was she just teasing him, or was she flirting with him? Anyway, he said hastily, I've taken care of the breathing problem for you. Come over here and look at the barrel. She stood close beside him. She was wearing an exotic, heady perfume. Struggling to breathe normally, he pointed out the breathing tube that he had fashioned for the lid of the barrel, and the cork which would plug the tube during the launching. Once we get the lid on this thing, he said, it will be airtight, as well as watertight. Or it will be if it's been properly constructed. We'll pump air in, and you'll put the plug in from the inside. You will be there, won't you? She asked. No, not at the launching, he said. She looked panic-stricken. But you have to be there. Really, it has to be you. I don't trust anyone else, Mr. McLaren. He took both of her hands between his own to calm her. They felt very small and frail in his grasp, and they were cold with fear. Instinctively, he chafed them as he talked to her. She made no attempt to move away. I can't be in two places at once, lass, he said. I shall have to trust Bill Hillsgrove to launch you. No! She tried to pull her hands away, but he held to them tightly. He'll be all right. I'm going to show him exactly where and when to release you. But why can't you be there? Because I have to be down below. That's where you'll need me. Danny and I will be putting the boat in down below the falls. As soon as you come over, we'll be out there to pick you up. Won't that be dangerous? She asked. No, he lied. No danger. We'll just motor out and pick you up. Nothing to it. He chose not to mention the 9 hours that Bobby Leach had been trapped behind the cataract while Joshua sat with a crew of rescuers waiting helplessly for the barrel to break free. She seemed to be calming down. Reluctantly, he released her hands. They were warm now, and he had no excuse to hold them. So, he said, once you're free and floating, you'll pull out the bung and you'll get fresh air while you're waiting for us. There's nothing to it. A memory came to him from long ago, and he found himself laughing loudly. Mr. McLaren, Evangeline said, that's the first proper laugh I've heard from you. Oh, he said, I'm sorry about that. On the whole, I don't find much to laugh about, but I'm not sure I should be laughing now. The woman did die. What woman? Oh, it was years ago. There was a fashion for a while, you know, of trying to ride the lower rapids. Down by the whirlpool. People rode all sorts of things. Boats, kayaks, rafts. There was one woman who launched herself and her dog in a barrel. He paused. It's always the women who give us trouble, he said. I'd like to see you manage without us, Evangeline snapped back. He seized the excuse to touch her hand. The world wouldn't be much of a place without women, he said. Anyway, off this woman goes in her barrel with her dog. Just a wee little terrier thing it was. She had a breathing tube just like the one I've made for you. But it seems that after she pulled out the bung, the dog got to the tube first. When we opened the barrel, the dog had his little nose stuck firmly in the tube. He was right as rain as soon as we got him unstuck. She was stone cold dead. Evangeline looked at him in horror. I'm sorry, he said. It's not really funny, is it? But I've always laughed about that dog. He was so determined to stay alive. After all, it wasn't his idea. No, said Evangeline. People have no right to involve innocent creatures in their dangerous adventures. Isn't that what Cornelia Braithwaite's done to you? Joshua asked. I'm no innocent creature, Evangeline retorted. And Cornelia's not forcing me. I need the money, Mr. McLaren.
My husband left me with enormous debts, and there are very few career choices open to a woman of my age and education. Miss Braithwaite advertised for a woman to undertake a dangerous but profitable enterprise, and I applied. I had nothing to lose and everything to gain. Come to think of it, Mr. McLaren, my motives are not so very different from yours. You're doing this for the money, aren't you? Joshua was silently appalled. How could she think it? How could she think that he'd commit her to the river for the sake of a few measly American dollars? He had all the dollars he'd ever need, and the only thing he was lacking was Evangeline herself. He turned away from her, knowing that his cause was hopeless. She was determined to think the worst of him.
"Aye," he mumbled. "If you choose to think it's for the money, then it's for the money. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have work to do. One of my best customers, who I might say pays me a lot better than your Miss Braithwaite, is getting awfully impatient to see his boat again, and I have to take it out for a test run." "Oh, yes, well, I have things to do, too," Evangeline said. "Thank you for your time, Mr. McLaren."
"Aye," he mumbled.
She hesitated, framed in the doorway, and then she said unexpectedly and rather breathlessly, "Could I come with you?"
"Where?"
"When you take the boat out. It's so long since I've been out on a boat."
"Well, I suppose."
"It would take my mind off other things," she said. "It's just so difficult just sitting around, thinking, waiting."
Joshua had some idea how she was feeling. He was doing anything he could to take his own mind off the launch.
"Aye," he said. "It must be difficult for you. You can come with me if you want to. I'll be down at the dock at 6 o'clock.
"That's supper time," she said. He wanted to kick himself. That was the end of the expedition. He could have said any time, but he chose supper time. Should he suggest they go now?
"I don't need supper," Evangeline said in a small voice. "I don't think I can eat. I'll be there. Goodbye, Joshua."
Joshua. She had called him Joshua. What should he do now? Should he call her Evangeline? Was it just a slip of the tongue, or had she meant some new kind of intimacy?
"Goodbye, Mrs. Evangeline," he said, and then she was gone, into the sunlight.